Now, we're done with the humeral shaft. We're going to move on down to the elbow now and start talking about the very difficult distal humerus fractures. These include both periarticular fractures with extension into the joint as well as extraarticular or supracondylar fractures. The avulsion fractures are extraarticular. Medial avulsion fractures, much more common than lateral. If the patient has ulnar nerve symptoms or greater than 1 centimeter displacement or instability of the elbow joint due to disruption of the ligamentous restraints, that would be an indication for ORIF. If you have a metaphyseal fracture or supracondylar fracture of the distal humerus, that by definition causes disruption of both the medial and the lateral columns. Those should be treated with ORIF. And just as with intraarticular fracture of the distal humerus, remember that the most stable construct is dual plates, two plates placed at 90 degrees relative to one another. So typically this means a plate placed along the medial aspect of the distal humerus and a plate, second plate placed posterolaterally. So two plates, 90 degrees relative to one another. Articular fractures can include both medial and lateral humeral condyle fractures. The Milts classification scheme is indicated here. And for both medial and lateral condyle fractures, remember that with a Milts 1, the lateral trochlear ridge is going to be intact. And that makes these fractures stable as opposed to Milts 2, where you do have violation of the lateral aspect of the trochlear ridge. So for Milts 1s, if they're non-displaced and they're stable, you can treat them with early range of motion. For a Milts 2, they are by definition unstable, and those need to be treated with open reduction and anatomical reduction of the joint surface. For pediatric considerations, remember that a Milts 1 is actually a Salter-Harris 4, and a Milts 2 is a Salter-Harris 2, and I'm sure that's probably covered with you in your pediatric lecture. Capitellum fractures are quite rare, but they can be significant. They're divided into types 1, 2, and 3, as you see here. I doubt that you would ever be tested on recognizing those different or classifying them. But it's important to recognize them. They're frequently associated with radial head fractures and posterior dislocations of the elbow. You must assess the range of motion for a possible mechanical block. A displaced capitellar fracture can actually function as a mechanical block to elbow flexion. If you have subtle capitellar irregularity, that would be suggestive of a sleeve fracture or a type 2 fracture, and CT scan can also be helpful in that diagnosis. If you have a non-displaced capitellar fracture, less than 2 millimeters displacement, you can treat those with early range of motion and close radiographic follow-up. If the fracture is significantly displaced and the fragment is large enough, you treat it with ORIF. It's a displaced small fragment, then you treat those with fragment excision. Now, what about intraarticular distal humerus fractures, intercondylar fractures of the distal humerus that have disruption of both columns? There are two factors that have been proven reliable for an acceptable outcome. The first is to obtain an anatomical reduction of the articular surface. The second factor then is to obtain stable fixation of the articular segment of the bone to the shaft of the bone. Again, you think of these as with a dual column approach, and that means dual plate fixation of both the medial column and the posterior column. And then the third factor that's been very critically shown to be associated with good results is early mobilization of the elbow joint. And of course, that necessitates you to obtain stable fixation. Typically, these are performed through a posterior approach. You can either do a triceps reflection or, more commonly, an osteotomy of the ulna, of the olecranon is indicated. And it's really critically important that you have adequate visualization of the articular surface of the distal humerus in order to obtain an acceptable result, because that's necessary to anatomically reduce the articular fracture extension. You have to be aware of the possibility of ulnar nerve injury with these approaches, and it's very important that you isolate and protect it. Whether or not you transpose the nerve is still a subject of debate among trauma surgeons, probably six of one, half dozen the other. There's nothing in the literature that mandates that you have to do an anterior nerve transposition. Articular reconstruction is critically important to anatomically reduce the fracture, intraarticular fracture extension, then dual plating and early range of motion, as we mentioned. Complications of distal humerus fractures, non-unions can occur anywhere from 1 to 10%, and that's usually due to poor surgical technique, inadequate or unstable fixation. You can occasionally get a non-union of your olecranon osteotomy. If you do the osteotomy correctly, however, that's quite rare, and for that reason, a chevron-type osteotomy, as is seen here, is the preferred technique. That allows you to get more stable fixation because the olecranon fragment really locks into the proximal ulna. You have a greater surface area of cancellous surfaces for healing, and you can get very good compression with intramedullary fixation across that olecranon osteotomy. Other complications, ulnar neuropathy is probably one of the most common problems in these fractures. It's especially seen in patients that have non-union of the distal humerus with a valgus deformity. Transposition of the ulnar nerve can minimize the incidence of this by minimizing your impingement on the hardware. Again, there's nothing in the literature that clearly shows that ulnar nerve transposition is necessary in these fractures. Heterotopic ossification, beware of this, particularly in the patient with a closed head injury. Also patients with severe soft tissue injury and patients in which you need to do an anterior approach to the elbow. HO is much more common in the anterior elbow than the posterior elbow. Also, if your surgery is delayed for any reason, that patient's going to be at a higher risk for heterotopic ossification. You want to prophylax against it. Radiation therapy is very effective, and excise it when it develops. The question always comes up about when to do your excision. Traditionally, we've always been taught that you wait until the bone is mature, although with recent articles, there has been a trend towards earlier excision and then postoperative radiation therapy. The Mori classification is useful for fractures of the olecranon. Type 1 fractures are truly non-displaced fractures. Those are actually quite rare. Of course, the mechanism of injury of an olecranon fracture is an axial load to the elbow, and the distal humerus is literally driven through the articular surface of the proximal ulna. So for that reason, it's quite rare to have a non-displaced fracture. If you do, you can certainly treat them non-operatively. You can splint the elbow between 45 and 90 degrees of flexion and, of course, follow them with serial radiographs. Displaced fractures of the olecranon should be treated with ORIF. A type 2A fracture is one that has minimal comminution and where the fracture of the proximal ulna does not extend distal to the coronoid. These fractures typically are quite stable and will do very well with conventional tension band wiring technique for surgical fixation. You can use a K-wires, as is shown here, plus your tension band wire. You can use an intramedullary screw, which is the technique that I prefer to use. Either one of those techniques will work quite well for these stable fractures. Type 2Bs are the ones where you have significant comminution, and you may also have fracture extension distal to the coronoid process. If you have either one of those factors, significant comminution of the proximal ulna or distal fracture extension distal to the coronoid process, those fractures are very unstable and will not do well with conventional tension band techniques. Those are the patients that you need to consider plate fixation of the proximal ulna is the best treatment of choice. And you can place the plate posteriorly, as is shown here, although that's not the technique that I prefer because of the significant prominence of the hardware posteriorly. More commonly, we'll place it on the medial aspect of the proximal ulna. And there are very good periarticular plating systems now available. What about excision of the olecranon? This is probably really of historical significance only. It is in the literature, however, that you can remove up to 50% of the proximal portion of the ulna and reattach the triceps in certain cases where there's a highly comminuted fracture that's very unstable and achieve reasonably good results. If you take more than 60% of the olecranon, however, you can get significant instability of the elbow joint or if there's an associated coronoid fracture present. And either transverse or oblique fractures can be excised, and advocates of this technique historically recommended that this eliminates articular incongruity and potential for post-injury degenerative arthrosis. Again, with current fracture fixation techniques, this is probably really not the preferred treatment for virtually any fracture of the proximal ulna. Coronoid fractures are quite difficult both to assess and to manage. The coronoid process is important for anterior stability of the elbow joint. It functions as an anterior buttress in the greater sigmoid fossa. And remember that it is important, and that is the site of attachment of the anterior bundle of the medial collateral ligament. That's the important portion of the medial collateral ligament. And if the coronoid is disrupted, particularly disrupted at its base, you can anticipate significant injury to the medial collateral ligament associated with that. Isolated coronoid fractures are rare. It's usually seen in combination with elbow dislocations or injuries of the proximal ulna or the radial head. You have to look for those injuries and rule them out. And if you have a patient that has an elbow dislocation, you can anticipate that if there is a concomitant coronoid fracture, that the elbow is likely going to be unstable post-reduction, particularly with large coronoid fractures. The Mori classification of coronoid fractures is based on the size of the coronoid fragment. A type 1 is just a shear fracture. That's caused by subluxation of the elbow and does not represent avulsion. Type 2 fractures can involve up to 50% of the coronoid process. Those are seen with elbow dislocations and radial head fractures. And type 3s are one that are much more significant involvement and actually extend into the lecranon process itself, and those can be very unstable. For you, the treatment of coronoid fractures is you treat the associated injuries, the elbow dislocation, the radial head fracture, the olecranon fracture, as mandated for the treatment of those injuries individually, and then you can perform an ORF of the coronoid process itself when there is significant stability, and that can be done with either a screw fixation or a non-absorbable suture, and the goal is to obtain stable reduction of the elbow joint so that you can begin early range of motion. Radial head fractures, head and neck fractures occur in 50 to 60% of elbow dislocations, so you really have to look for those when you see a patient with an elbow dislocation. The mechanism of injury is typically an axial load onto a pronated forearm. You have to evaluate the ipsilateral distal radial ulnar joint and the wrist because of the possibility of damage to the interosseous membrane with these injuries. And the fracture is most common in the anterolateral portion of the radial head, and that's significant, and that is an area where there is typically a little articular cartilage and the subchondral bone is the weakest. That's why it fractures in that area. The radiographic imaging of radial head fractures, an AP, a true lateral, and sometimes you can get this radial head capitellum view, which is taken with the beam oriented 45 degrees to the flexed elbow as you see here, and that can really show you very clearly both the capitellum and the radial head. The Mason classification system, type 1 fractures are minimally or non-displaced fractures defined as less than 2 millimeters of intra-articular displacement. There typically will be no mechanical block to elbow range of motion in these fractures, and they will do quite well with simple conservative non-operative treatment. Type 2 fractures are where you have displacement of either the head itself greater than 2 millimeters or displacement of the neck with angulation. Those fractures, you can have a significant mechanical block to elbow range of motion as well as potential for post-traumatic arthrosis of the radiocapitellar joint, and those fractures would be ones that could be considered for operative intervention. And then the type 3 fractures are where you have severe comminution and with displacement and angulation of the radial head or the neck. So type 1 fractures, make sure there's no mechanical block. You may need to aspirate the joint and inject it for pain control to do your clinical examination and assure that there's no mechanical block. And you treat those with early range of motion. Treat them with a sling or splint for just a few days and allow them to start range of motion because these are stable injuries as soon as their pain tolerance will allow. You can expect that there may be some loss of extension, usually less than 15 degrees with appropriate treatment. For type 2, you want to fix the radial head and or the radial neck when possible. Beware of associated injuries, either elbow dislocations, distal radial ulnar joint injuries, or a damage to the interosseous ligament. A CT scan can be helpful. Typically, the simple type 2 radial head fractures can be very effectively managed with screw fixation of the radial head fragment, as is you see in these radiographs here. Type 3 fractures. The take-home point here is to remember that acute excision of the radial head is never indicated without doing something to replace it. So do not excise the radial head and leave it without some sort of concomitant radial head replacement. We try to fix every radial head that we can. If the fracture anatomy will allow you to get fixation, and there are periarticular plates available now for the proximal radius that will allow you to get good fixation, even locked fixation into the radial head and neck, you should try to preserve the radial head. If you think that the radial head is not reconstructable, then you excise it and replace it with a prosthetic implant, a metallic implant, not a silastic implant. So surgical approach to the radial head is typically the Coker approach using the posterior lateral. It goes between the anconeus, innervated by the radial nerve, and the extensor carpal nares, innervated by the posterior osseous nerve. You want to keep the arm pronated during your approach to protect the posterior osseous nerve. And remember that you have to place your hardware within the so-called safe zone, which is basically a 110-degree arc of the humerus where it's safe to put your screws. If you go outside that arc, then you're going to run the risk of impingement on the articulation between the proximal radius and the ulna. The Essex-Lopresti lesion is a sort of a peculiar injury where you have a radial head fracture with interosseous membrane disruption and associated dislocation of the distal radial ulnar joint. Again, that's why when you have a patient with a radial head fracture, you have to radiographically image the entire forearm, including the distal radial ulnar joint, to rule out the presence of an Essex-Lopresti lesion. The clinical findings will be the ulna is displaced dorsally relative to the radius, so the DRUJ is dislocated. The hand will be present with radial deviation, and the patient will have virtually complete block to supination. The treatment of this, again, do not resect the radial head. Treat it with either ORIF or prosthetic replacement, and the reason this, of course, is to prevent proximal migration of the radius. Prosthetic replacement, silastic head implants will not prevent proximal radial migration, and they have been shown to be associated with significant silicone synovitis. So for that reason, the silicone radial head implant should not be used. So use a metallic head implant. They've been shown to be associated with improved results. You can expect that there may be some loosening, and now that we have modular implants that are available, the results have been even better. Prosthetic replacement is indicated, of the radial head is indicated for patients where you have significant elbow dislocation and instability, also the Essex-Lopresti lesion, and remember that you have to fix the lateral collateral ligament and the associated coronoid fracture if those injuries are present concomitantly. Now, moving on to elbow dislocations, you define them as relative to the position of the forearm, relative to the humerus. So this would, of course, be a posterior dislocation. The posterior lateral is the most common type and represents greater than 80% of all elbow dislocations. The other types indicated there are less common. Associated injuries with elbow dislocations are the rule, actually, rather than the exception. You can have radial head and neck fractures in up to 50 to 60%, medial lateral epicondyle fractures, coronoid fractures, and you especially want to beware of the so-called terrible triad of the elbow, which consists of an elbow dislocation with an associated coronoid fracture and a radial head fracture. Those will require operative intervention. The functional anatomy of the elbow, remember that the primary stabilizers are the ulnar trochlear articulation itself. You know, of course, the distal humerus, the trochlea is recessed into the proximal portion of the ulna. Then you have the anterior band of the medial collateral ligament, which is, again, the most important medial primary restraint. And, again, that attaches directly to the base of the coronoid process. So that's suspected to be disrupted in significant coronoid fractures, then the ulnar portion of the lateral collateral ligament. The secondary stabilizers then would be the radial head, the capsular attachments, and the various muscles that cross the elbow joint. The medial collateral ligament is the primary stabilizer of the elbow. It allows resistance to valgus deforming force along with the lateral column itself, which consists of the radial head and the capitellum. There are three components. There's the anterior oblique band, which is the primary stabilizer and inserts, again, at the coronoid process. Then you have the posterior oblique band and the transverse band. So, the medial collateral ligament is the primary medial stabilizer of the elbow joint, especially the anterior band. In full extension, it provides 30% of the valgus stability. In 90 degrees of flexion, it provides over 50% of the valgus stability. And when you have more extension, then you can more rely on the intact lateral bony column for your stability. Resection of the anterior band of the MCL will cause gross instability of the elbow joint except in extension. And again, this goes back to why we try to fix the significant coronoid fractures, because that restores the proper anatomical relationship of the medial collateral ligament and will prevent late instability. The lateral ligaments are responsible for prevention of posterior subluxation and rotation of the ulna, and if they're disrupted, you can get posterior lateral rotatory instability. That can be the treatment of elbow dislocations. The initial treatment of all dislocations, of course, is non-surgical. You anatomically reduce the ulnotrochlear articulation. Then you want to check the range of motion and stability post-reduction by taking the elbow both into full extension and full flexion whenever possible. And typically this can be done with a relatively minimal sedation in the emergency room to get the elbow reduced. Post-reduction films are necessary to rule out concomitant fracture and confirm your reduction. If you have a stable reduction, then you splint them in 90 degrees of flexion for several days and then begin early range of motion. If you have an unstable reduction, you may consider immobilizing the elbow for up to 2 to 3 weeks. If you immobilize them greater than 3 weeks, that has been shown to be detrimental with long-term functional outcomes with increased risk of significant elbow stiffness. So simple dislocation results depend heavily on how long they're immobilized. Again, with the adult elbow, it's almost never indicated to immobilize the adult elbow greater than 2 weeks, and that's kind of a thing you want to remember. And there's no clear advantage to surgical repair of either the medial or lateral ligaments acutely in simple dislocations. Now, elbow dislocation can lead to a spectrum of instability, which is diagrammatically represented here from stage 1 to 3. Stage 1 is the posterolateral rotatory subluxation. Stage 2 is where you have perch or incomplete dislocation with damage to the anterior capsule. And stage 3 is the end result of this type of syndrome, where you have either a partial complete tear of the medial collateral ligament. And it's the anterior band of the MCL, again, which is the primary restraint primary medial stabilizer of the elbow. Now, how can you test for valgus instability? And these are the patients where you would suspect posterolateral rotatory instability. You can do this pivot shift test, if you will, by applying extension, valgus, and supination forces. If you get subluxation, then that's an evidence of a positive pivot shift test and posterolateral rotatory instability. You can reduce it by applying flexion and pronation, and usually surgical treatment is necessary for these to reconstruct the lateral ulnar collateral ligament. And Mori's results have reported 80% successful results in these patients with significant posterolateral rotatory instability secondary to damage to the lateral collateral ligament. Now, moving on down to the forearm. Now, radius and ulna fractures, non-operative treatment really has very limited indications for forearm fractures in adult patients. The one exception to that where you can consider non-operative treatment is in the isolated ulnar shaft fracture where you have appropriate alignment. And these would be distal two-thirds ulnar shaft fractures, not proximal ulnar shaft fracture, but distal two-thirds fractures where you have less than 50% displacement and less than 10 degrees of angulation. Those fractures have been shown to do quite well with conservative closed treatment in a functional fracture brace, union rates over 96%. If you have a proximal one-third ulnar shaft fracture, or if you have greater than 50% displacement or greater than 10 degrees of angulation, those are the ulnar shaft fractures that warrant formal ORIF. Now, a non-displaced radial shaft fracture is something that's quite rare. When you see it, there's a temptation, of course, to treat those non-operatively. However, you must be certain that the radial bow is maintained, because that's the most important determinant in forearm fractures with restoration of forearm pronation and supination. You can also get delayed healing of these because the ulna itself is intact, and probably for even non-displaced radial shaft fractures, ORIF is the preferred treatment option. The ORIF for both bone forearm fractures is typically performed through separate approaches. Resist the temptation to try to reduce these through a single approach because of the very high risk of synostosis of the forearm caused by that. You typically will want to do a Volar or Henry approach for treatment of radial shaft fractures. It's extensile. You can literally expose the entire length of the radius. It utilizes the interval between the brachioradialis and the pronator teres proximally, and the flexor carpi radialis distally, and that is an internervous plane. For proximal third radial shaft fractures, occasionally the dorsal or Thompson approach can be indicated. That does place the posterior osseous nerve at risk, and you can reduce that risk by maintaining the forearm in pronation. It utilizes the interval between the ECRB and the extensor digital recumbens proximally and the EPL distally. For ulnar shaft fractures, those are approached through the ulna has a subcutaneous border, and you can approach the ulnar shaft quite easily through an internervous approach between the extensor carpial nares and the flexor carpial nares. The standard technique for plate fixation of ulnar shaft fractures should be use of a small fragment 3.5 millimeter dynamic compression plate. Again, you do not want to use a recon plate. You do not want to use a one-third tubular plate. You should use a 3.5 millimeter DCP for adequate fixation of the forearm. What about intramedullary nailing? That has been looked at, really is no longer advocated due to the fact that you cannot get adequate rotational stability, you cannot get adequate axial stability, and it's very difficult to maintain the radial bow. And again, the most important determinant long-term with functional outcome in forearm fractures is to anatomically restore the radial bow. Postoperatively, you treat them with a splint and early range of motion exercises unless you have significant proximal or distal joint injury to the elbow or the wrist, respectively. Galeazzi fractures, a couple eponyms you probably need to remember. The classic Galeazzi fracture is a fracture of the distal one-third of the radial shaft with an associated dorsal dislocation of the ulnar, a distal radial ulnar joint injury. We now will commonly refer to a fracture as a Galeazzi fracture if there's any forearm fracture with an associated DRUJ injury. The treatment is to perform anatomical plate fixation of the radial shaft and then stabilize the DRUJ. If the DRUJ is irreducible, you should suspect interposition of the extensor carpal nares tendon. That needs to be removed. Your treatment for the DRUJ injury can consist either of immobilization of the patient for 6 weeks and supination. I think quite more appropriately is to do surgical stabilization with pin fixation across the DRUJ, and that can allow you to keep the patient out of a long splint immobilization of their wrist and their elbow. And the pin can, of course, be removed in the office, and you typically will leave the pin in for about 4 weeks. What are the radiographic signs of DRUJ injury you can look for? Well, you can look for the presence of an ulnar styloid fracture, a large ulnar styloid fracture. On the AP view, you can look for widening of the joint. This is diagrammatically represented here. You can see there, this is abnormal widening of the DRUJ here. On the lateral view, of course, you're going to look for dorsal dislocation or dorsal displacement of the ulnar relative to the radius. And you also want to look for radial shortening, which you also see evidence of here. This is a classic of a Galeazzi equivalent, if you will, and this is treated with ORF, plate fixation of the radial shaft, and stabilization of the ulnar styloid fracture. The Montasia fracture involves dislocation of the radial head associated with a fracture of the ulnar shaft. The significant thing about a Montasia injury is 20% of them can present with posterior osseous nerve injuries. There are types 1 through 4 described. You will not be tested on recognizing those types, but the important fact is just to remember that there can basically be different types of displacement of the radial head, either anterior, posterior, or lateral, and that's how you classify them. The treatment is to perform anatomical plate reduction and fixation of the ulnar shaft and then close reduction of the radial head. In the vast majority of these injuries, the radial head will be stable in reduction once the ulnar shaft is anatomically reduced. What about complications in forearm fractures? Well, complications can occur both to the injury itself as well as your treatment. You can have a compartment syndrome in forearm fractures, and that's important to remember. The patient that has sustained a high-energy crushing type injury, as well as patients with severe open fractures, low-velocity gunshot wounds, patients that have vascular disruption or coagulopathy. And again, the physical examination is critically important in these patients looking for pain with passive stretch. Neurovascular injuries are quite uncommon in closed fractures, except for the posterior osseous nerve injury that you can see with Montasia fractures, as I mentioned. The one instance where you can see nerve injuries is in type 3 open fractures, and this can dramatically affect the outcome because typically these are not neuropraxias. They are significant nerve injuries due to the associated significant soft tissue injury, and those have a relatively poor prognosis. One thing that you can also need to be aware of with forearm fractures is the possibility of refracture following removal of the plate. The factors that have been shown to be associated with an increased risk of refracture include use of large fragment plates, 4.5 millimeter plates, significant initial fracture comminution, persistent fracture lucency radiographically, and removing the plates too early. If you're going to remove plates from the forearm, it should not be done before a minimum of 18 months have passed, because that's how long it takes for these fractures to remodel. Again, because you're going for anatomical reduction, you're really relying on primary bone healing to occur, and that's how long it takes for the fracture, the bone, to recover its optimum stability. So don't use 4.5 millimeter plates, and don't take the plates off before 18 months is the take-home points there. Now, what about synostosis between the radius and the ulna? The risk factors for synostosis, the one that I already mentioned, is trying to fix the radius and the ulna through a single incision. Also, if your surgical treatment is delayed for any reason, if both of the bones are fractured at the same level, if they're high energy, if you have a concomitant closed head injury, if you develop an infection, if the screws are too long and penetrate through the interosseous membrane, or if you have bone grafting into the region of the interosseous membrane, those can be risk factors. The management of synostosis is to resect it. Of course, course, the initial management would be to and then you have to do prophylaxis to keep it from reforming. You want to delay your resection until you think that the bone is mature, and that typically requires about a year out from the injury. Really, the results of treatment after synostosis resection are very poor. The only situation where you can obtain some improved functional results are really in the middle third of the forearm. Proximal and distal synostosis really both have very poor prognosis. Distal radius fractures. The last thing we're going to talk about in the upper extremity are the most common of all orthopedic injuries or orthopedic fractures. 50% of them will be intra-articular and involve either the radiocarpal or the radial ulnar joints. They have a bimodal distribution very similar to tibial plateau fractures, where in young patients they're the result of high-energy trauma, whereas in older patients they're quite commonly the result of low-energy falls in osteoporotic bone. There are multiple different classification schemes for distal radius fractures that either classify these on mechanistic or anatomic locations. The Fernandez classification scheme is based on the mechanism of injury. The Frickman classification scheme involves whether there's radiocarpal and or radial ulnar joint involvement. The Maloney classification scheme divides the intra-articular fractures into four types. And then, of course, there's the very comprehensive yet cumbersome AO classification system for these fractures. The radiographic evaluation of the distal radius should consist of good PA and lateral views. Remember your normal anatomical features. On the lateral view, the normal volar tilt of the distal radius is 11 degrees. So volar tilt or apex dorsal angulation of the distal radius is 11 degrees. On your PA view, the normal radial height is 12 millimeters. This is the radial height here, which is measured from the alignment between the distal radius and the ulna articular surface to the tip of the radial styloid, and your normal radial inclination would be 23 degrees. And you want to compare that often to the contralateral side as a control. If you have an ulnar styloid fracture, that is denotes a very high energy trauma to the wrist and a greater problems with instability and radial fracture, distal radius fracture displacement. All right, what are the criteria for an acceptable reduction, an acceptable closed reduction of the distal radius? Well, you want to have change in the palmar tilt less than 10 degrees. So, of course, practically what that means is you can accept basically an up to neutral alignment on your lateral image. If you have any amount of dorsal tilt or apex volar angulation, that by definition represents greater than a 10-degree change in the palmar tilt, and that would be an indication for more aggressive intervention. If you have radial shortening greater than 2 millimeters, if you have change in the radial inclination greater than 5 degrees, or if you have greater than 2 millimeters of articular step-off. These would all be indications for a more aggressive surgical intervention. Now, determining the stability of the fracture is a key component of the reduction, and the pre-reduction x-rays have been shown to be the best predictor of stability. So if you have a fracture that has significant displacement, significant fracture comminution, particularly dorsal comminution, you can predict that those are the ones that are going to be unstable and are probably not going to do well with conservative closed treatment. The instability criteria consist of a widely displaced intra-articular fracture, excessive volar dorsal comminution, significant dorsal angulation greater than 20 degrees, or a patient that has significant osteoporosis, initial fracture displacement or shortening greater than 5 millimeters, again, dorsal comminution is listed. The articular margin fractures, such as the volar Barton's fracture, those are going to be, by definition, unstable and require operative intervention. And significant palmarly or volarly displaced and comminuted extra-articular fractures, such as the Smith's fracture. Those are unstable. Treatment options for distal radius fractures. Well, cast treatment is certainly tried and true and is appropriate for certain distal radius fractures. You have to follow the patient very closely for displacement in the cast. Again, you should be able to predict the ones that are going to be unstable based on your preoperative radiographs. Of course, cast treatment can cause skin problems. If you have a patient that you're treating closed and the patient loses reduction, repeat closed reduction of those injuries is associated with 50% or less satisfactory results. So in other words, if you have a patient that you treat closed, they lose their reduction, their alignment's now unacceptable, that would be an indication for surgical intervention. Percutaneous pinning has been shown to result in excellent anatomic results and functional outcomes when it's used appropriately. It's very useful to maintain the sagittal alignment in unstable extra-articular fractures that are stable on the volar surface. So in other words, fractures where you have dorsal angulation with minimal comminution, you can realign those fractures in the sagittal plane and very nicely stabilize them with one or more percutaneous pins. If you have significant volar or dorsal comminution, however, percutaneous pinning alone is not a good technique as it does not provide adequate stability. The different techniques that have been described for percutaneous pinning are listed there. The one that's really probably of most interest is the Kapanji intrafocal pinning, which can be useful in certain dorsally displaced distal radius fractures to affect reduction in the sagittal plane. External fixation is important adjunct in treatment of distal radius fractures. The one thing that you can remember is that external fixation alone cannot reliably restore the 10-degree palmar tilt that the distal radius normally has. And the problem is that the volar ligaments are stronger and become taut, while the dorsal ligaments are not restored to the adequate length. Non-spanning external fixator can give you better control and better fracture reduction, but of course that relies on you having a large intact segment of the distal radius to work with in order to avoid having to span across the wrist. Technical points for external fixation: you want to really limit the duration. Typically 7 to 8 weeks in the external fixator is the maximum amount of time that should be that the patient should wear the frame. And also, it's very important to treat the patients postoperatively with aggressive occupational therapy to maintain their digital range of motion. Also, one of the most common technical mistakes made with external fixation distal radius fractures is over-distraction. And you really want to avoid distracting the carpus any greater than several millimeters. And you also want to avoid placing the wrist in marked volar flexion and ulnar deviation. Those are all factors that have been shown to be associated with a very poor outcome in external fixation of distal radius fractures, particularly with development of reflex sympathetic dystrophy. So you want to maintain the wrist in a neutral position and avoid over-distraction. Those are the key points. If you use external fixation for the appropriate indications and using appropriate techniques, you can get 80 to 90% good to excellent results. What about complications of external fixation? Again, these can be related to the inadequacy of the reduction itself, problems with pin tracks, of course, and complications related to the fracture pattern. If you fail to adequately restore the palmar tilt or the radiocarpal alignment, in other words, you don't get anatomical reduction, you can expect that the patient's not going to do well. Again, avoid over-distraction. That can lead to skin difficulties, stiffness, RSD. You can get late displacement in patients treated with external fixation. That can be seen particularly in patients that have osteoporotic bone where adequate healing has not occurred. And, of course, you can't get non-unions. Pin complications are listed there. They can occur both with pin insertion. I would strongly recommend that when you're doing your external fixation of distal radius fractures that you place your forearm, your radial shaft pins under direct visualization. Make an incision, visualize the structures. If you've ever been there, you know that it's almost impossible to avoid penetration of either a musculotendinous unit or, more commonly, the superficial radial nerve if you do not place these pins in under direct visualization. So make an incision, make sure you put the pins in properly. Avoid injury to the superficial radial nerve. You can also get median neuropathy, RSD, decreased motion and grip strength as complications of external fixation. Now, what about ORIF? When is ORIF indicated? Well, it's certainly indicated for significant intra-articular displacement, articular marginal fractures such as the dorsal or volar Barton's fracture, or patients that have highly comminuted intra-articular fracture extension, patients that have significant volar comminution, significant proximal extension into the metadiaphyseal junction. Those are probably going to require plate fixation and not do well with closed treatment techniques. If you have an associated fracture of the distal ulnar shaft, and also in some of these fracture patterns, you may need to consider using ORIF in combination with other techniques such as percutaneous pinning and, in certain situations, external fixation to obtain adequate fracture alignment and fixation. Arthroscopy has been shown to help with certain intra-articular fracture patterns, but I think it's fair to say that its role is not clearly defined and it's not preferred by orthopedic trauma surgeons, I can tell you for sure. Complications in distal radius fractures include neuropathy anywhere up to 1 to 12%. However, if you have a high energy fracture, that incidence can be as high as 30%. The most commonly injured nerve is the median nerve, of course. You can also get an ulnar nerve injury with concomitant damage to the distal radial ulnar joint. If you have a nerve injury, you basically need to decompress the medial nerve, do a carpal tunnel release. If the patient has progressive paresthesias or the abnormal neurologic exam does not respond to your closed reduction, if you do a closed reduction, minimize the dorsal tilt or the apex volar angulation, and the patient has persistent neurologic deficit, that would be an indication for acute carpal tunnel release. The carpal tunnel pressure is lowest with the wrist in neutral position, so again, you want to avoid placing the wrist into marked volar flexion because that can actually increase the pressure in the carpal tunnel. And then the association with reflex sympathetic dystrophy is not well understood, but we do know that it does occur with certain distal radius fractures, and when it does occur, is a dreaded complication. Tendon problems, DRUJ injuries can entrap either the extensor carpal nerus or the extensor digiti minimi. Again, if you have an irreducible DRUJ suspect interposition of the ECU, and that needs to be removed. What about tendon rupture due to attrition? The most commonly injured tendon in that manner is the extensor pollicis longus, of course, crossing around the dorsal of the wrist over Lister's tubercle. If the patient has tenosynovitis, then that would require an early release of the EPL, and then and if you have a rupture of the EPL, then a transfer with the EIP would be indicated. Other complications, radiocarpal arthrosis, 1 to 2%, up to 30% in different reports in the literature. The one thing that we do know is associated with an increased risk of radiocarpal arthrosis is inadequate articular reduction. So articular displacement greater than 1 to 2 millimeters will invariably lead to radiographic arthrosis. And if this occurs in a young adult patient, the vast majority of them, virtually 100% of them, are going to be symptomatic and are going to require some sort of salvage treatment. This, again, stresses the need for an anatomical reduction to reduce the articular surface, in particularly in young patients. Malunions and non-unions, if you have an intra-articular malunion, you should consider taking that down greater than 6 weeks out. If you have an extra-articular malunion, then that's typically an apex, marked apex volar angulation of the distal radius. That is going to require an opening wedge osteotomy dorsally, stable plate fixation of the distal radius, and bone grafting. You also can consider doing ulnar shortening if you cannot anatomically restore the radial length. Now, the last thing is distal radial ulnar joint injuries. These are typically underappreciated and often ignored. They're perhaps the most common source of pain and limited range of motion and disability following distal radius fractures. And the primary factor in preventing disability related to the DRUJ is to anatomically reduce the distal radius. If the distal radius fracture is anatomically reduced, then the distal radial ulnar joint will likely follow and cause minimal problems. Remember that the DRUJ has both rotation and translation, and there's the triangular fibrocartilage complex that is the primary stabilizer of the DRUJ. So the TFC is very important. Evaluation of the DRUJ clinically consists of assessment of the range of motion and stability, as well as examining the contralateral extremity. Again, on the radiographs, you're looking on the plane films for widening on the AP view, dorsal displacement on the lateral view, CT scan, MRI, and arthrogram can sometimes be useful as well. The ulnar styloid fracture, when present, again, heralds a high-energy trauma to the wrist. You really need to suspect a high incidence of instability, especially with large ulnar styloid fractures. Fractures through the base are often associated with rupture of the triangular fibrocartilage complex and resultant instability of the DRUJ. You can get a painful hypertrophic nonunion in the absence of instability. If you have a significantly displaced ulnar styloid fracture through the base, then you should consider ORF for those fractures. If you have a smaller fragment that's painful, you can consider excision, but you have to preserve the ulnar attachment of the triangular fibrocartilage complex. Now, DRUJ disruption can be classically associated with a Galeazzi fracture, as we mentioned, which is a fracture of the radial shaft in association with a DRUJ injury. The radiographic diagnosis can be complicated by gross fracture displacement, and the clinical diagnosis can be made by instability of the DRUJ. The treatment is important to recognize these and treat them acutely, because acute treatment has been shown to be superior to late treatment. Anatomical reduction of the DRUJ, you can cast them in supination for 6 weeks. Again, I would strongly recommend using a pin fixation, percutaneous pinning across the DRUJ with the wrist placed in neutral position, again, with cast immobilization. Now, what about ulnar impaction with distal radius fractures? And that occurs when basically you have significant radial shortening. You can get positive ulnar variants, and that leads to altered mechanics in the radiocarpal articulation, as well as lunate chondromalacia. You can get degenerative tears of the triangular fibular cartilage complex, and these would be the treatment options: radial osteotomy, ulnar shortening, debridement, or distal ulnar resection, as you see mentioned there. And this is what it looks like here. The previous slide showed the normal radiocarpal anatomy, and here you have a patient that has an ulnar positive variance, and you see there's significant impingement on the lunate in the distal radius. This is what it looks like arthroscopically. Here's a radiographic representation of, again, distinct ulnar positive variance, flattening of the lunate facet of the distal radius, and chondromalacia. This is what it looks like arthroscopically, and this is the treatment for it, to basically do a shortening of the distal ulna and restore the normal variance of the distal ulna relative to the radius. You can also do a so-called wafer procedure, which is where you excise this portion of the distal ulna, preserving the ulnar attachments of the triangular fibrocartilage complex. So DRUJ arthrosis, the clinical findings are pain, limited supination pronation of the forearm, decreased grip strength. The treatment for it would be a resection arthroplasty that can be either through a matched or a DERA-type procedure. Here's a patient that has significant DRUJ arthrosis secondary to malunion of a distal radius fracture, and the patient gets treated, as you see here, with resection of the distal ulna through a DERA-type procedure and can be expected to have a reasonable functional result. All right, so that concludes the upper extremity trauma, and the last thing I'm going to do with this section is just go through the top 10 facts that Dick has compiled for you for upper extremity trauma, and be a good thing to review maybe the night before you go into your exam, because these are the things that he has identified will frequently show up on in-training and board examinations. Clavicle fractures, treat them with plate fixation only if the fracture is medially unstable, and this would consist of the type 2 or the distal clavicle fractures where you have significant medial instability, or if you have an open fracture or a fracture where there's significant skin compromise or a concomitant vascular injury. Remember that there's a very high incidence of rotator cuff tear in patients greater than 40 years of age who have a shoulder dislocation. Beware of posterior shoulder dislocation, the patient with the isolated lesser tuberosity fracture. I think I've driven that point into the ground. The patients will be clinically unable to externally rotate. When evaluating any shoulder trauma, remember that you need an AP, axillary, and a scapular Y view. Treatment of choice for isolated humeral shaft fractures is a functional cast brace closed treatment. There are specific indications that should be followed for operative intervention, which include open fractures, segmental fractures, the polytraumatized patient, the floating elbow, the patient with concomitant vascular injury. Remember that if there is a higher incidence of non-union of humeral shaft fractures treated with ORIF compared to closed treatment, if the ORIF procedure is not done properly. So in order to do it properly, you need to use a broad or narrow 4.5 millimeter DCP, get a minimum of 6 cortices above and below the fracture. Remember also that you can consider intramedullary nailing acutely in the polytraumatized patient and allow that extremity to become a weight-bearing extremity. Radial nerve deficit is associated with closed humeral shaft fractures. It's seen quite commonly. In most cases, it should be managed with observation. Do your electrodiagnostic testing at 6 weeks. If you see fasciculations, you can consider observation, because that's evidence that the reinnervation is occurring. If you have fibrillation potentials, that's evidence of denervation, and you can consider exploration and repair. Elbow trauma, any option that you will see listed on your questions that recommends immobilization of the adult elbow for greater than 2 weeks is incorrect, and you can probably cross off that one and go on to consider the other options. Elbow dislocations, the medial collateral ligament is torn in all elbow dislocations. Beware of late posterior lateral rotatory instability. That can be diagnosed with the pivot shift test, and the treatment for it is to reconstruct the lateral ulnar collateral ligament. 80% good to excellent results reported with that technique. Radial head fractures, do not excise the radial head acutely. If you do excise it, you try to preserve the radial head whenever possible. If it is necessary to excise it, always perform prosthetic replacement using a metallic implant. Galeazzi fractures treat the radius with ORF and either immobilize the wrist in supination to maintain reduction of the DRUJ or pin the DRUJ. If the DRUJ is irreducible, suspect interposition of the extensor carpal nares. Montasia fractures treat those with ORF or the ulna and close reduction of the radial head. If irreducible, you should suspect that the annular ligament is the culprit, and that will need to be addressed with an open procedure. Remember that Montasia fractures do have a 20% incidence of posterior osseous nerve injury. Pre-reduction films are the best predictor of stability in distal radius fractures. Post-traumatic shortening of the radius can result in ulnar impaction syndrome, and high incidence of TFC tears can be seen with distal radius fractures, and we talked about all those just now. The treatment of choice for an isolated ulnar shaft fracture with appropriate alignment, less than 50% of displacement, less than 10 degrees of angulation, is a functional cast brace. Now, that concludes the upper extremity section. I'm going to just now try to briefly go through the pelvic ring section, and I promise I'm just as exhausted as you guys are, so I'll try to go through this relatively quickly. And so we've come sort of full circle. We started with the acetabulum yesterday, and now we've gone through the lower extremity, now the upper extremity injuries, and we're going to end up with pelvic ring injuries. Outline here of this portion of the talk is listed there, and we're going to end with the top 10 facts for pelvic trauma. Remember that as far as the anatomy of the pelvic ring is concerned, the pelvic ring has absolutely zero inherent bony stability. It's formed by the union of the innominate bones with the symphyseal ligaments anteriorly and the posterior, the sacroiliac ligaments posteriorly. So the stability of the pelvic ring is entirely dependent upon these ligamentous structures. There's no intrinsic stability. Remember that the posterior ligaments, the interosseous ligaments, and the posterior sacroiliac ligaments are the strongest ligaments, and those are actually the strongest ligaments in the human body. We're all familiar with the keystone arch and the suspension bridge concept for the alignment and stability of the posterior pelvic ring. Just remember that the pelvic ring relies on these multiple concerted ligamentous structures to maintain its appropriate alignment and stability. Now, what about the acute management of pelvic ring trauma? Well, remember that pelvic ring injuries are very common in blunt, high-energy trauma. There's a large spectrum of associated injuries, and the mortality rate, if you look at all patients with significant pelvic ring injuries, can be as high as 15%. Not all of them necessarily die from their pelvic injury itself, but it is an indication of significant high-energy trauma. And if a patient presents with a significant pelvic fracture and they have subsequently died, then hemorrhage is usually the culprit. Survivors with significant pelvic ring injuries will average up to 2 additional injuries, either in the orthopedic injuries or other organ system injuries. Non-survivors will have up to 3 additional injuries. And 60 to 80% of patients with pelvic ring injuries will have some associated extremity trauma. So again, concomitant injuries are really the rule rather than the exception. You can also have injuries, of course, to other organ systems, urogenital injuries in 12 to 20%, lumbosacral plexus injuries in up to 10%, and remember that 20% of these patients will present either on their initial presentation or during their trauma resuscitation with hemodynamic instability. Physical findings can include scrotal or labial swelling or ecchymosis. You can have abnormal positioning of the lower extremities, malrotation of one limb relative to the other, for example, or you can have pain or movement of the pelvis with bimanual exam. You're grasping the pelvic bimanually in the region of the anterior superior iliac spine and assessing for instability. It's not something that you want, you know, everybody, including the housekeeper, coming in and doing, because it can potentially, you know, displace some clot and cause some bleeding, but it is important for at least one person to do it on the team to assess the stability of the pelvic ring. Physical examination, you want to remember also to examine the perineum, the vagina, the rectum with these injuries to rule out the presence of an occult open injury, because we know that open pelvic fractures are associated with dramatically worse prognosis. And it's very important that those be recognized and the soft tissue component of the injury be managed very aggressively. Also, focused neurologic exam is very important to rule out lumbosacral plexus injury. The radiographic evaluation, the AP x-ray is what you start with. You're looking not only at the pelvic ring, but also at the acetabulum and the proximal femur. Also, inlet and outlet views, which will show, consider doing dye studies of the urogenital system, either a retrograde urethrogram or a cystogram, and then CT scanning. The radiographic evaluation, this shows the importance of a CT scan here to help you quantitate and classify these posterior injuries. This is an example of an inlet view. What an inlet view shows you is anterior posterior displacement of the hemipelvis. So that's what you're looking for on this view. Here's an example of a patient that has a significant pelvic ring injury, and you see that you're able to see here the left hemipelvis has significant anterior displacement here, as well as disruption of the iliac wing here posteriorly. On the this is an example of the same inlet view post reconstruction showing anatomical reduction of the fracture. The outlet view, what you're looking for is cranial or caudal displacement of one hemipelvis relative to the other. And the ideal outlet view should be taken with the pubic symphysis basically just below the S1 foramen. This is actually a little bit high here. And this is an example of I believe the same patient that Dick showed earlier, where you see that this same left hemipelvis is not only anteriorly displaced, but also caudally displaced as well. So this is a very unstable pelvic ring injury, and here's the same patient post-reduction with a very nice reduction obtained. Urogenital injury should be suspected in any patients that have anterior ring injuries, pubic symphysis disruption, or significant pubic rami fractures. Bladder ruptures, urethral disruptions can occur. If you see blood at the meatus or on clinical examination, if you have a high riding prostate, those would be indications for proceeding with a retrograde urethrogram to specifically rule out the presence of a urogenital injury. Open injuries to the pelvic ring, again, are associated with a significantly worse prognosis, greater morbidity and mortality, aggressive IND, antibiotics, fracture stabilization. If the patient has known to have rectal or perineal communication, then you should communicate with your general trauma surgeon and strongly recommend that the patient undergo a diverting colostomy. The classification of pelvic ring injuries is based on a force vector analysis. The Young-Burgess classification from shock trauma classifies them based on anterior-posterior compression, lateral compression, or vertical shear, and then there are certain ones that have a combined mechanism of injury. This is the Young-Burgess classification system here. Again, the lateral compression injuries are from a direct lateral blow to the pelvis, and anterior-posterior compression injury, the classic open book type mechanism, and then your vertical shear injury, which typically occur in falls from a height or motor vehicle collisions, and then there are certain ones that have a combination of several of those. The force vector analysis that Dr. Burgess described really has been shown to be very useful in predicting mortality, blood requirement for these patients, as well as associated injuries. You see that patients that have an anterior posterior compression injury were shown to have a blood requirement during resuscitation of 28 units. So these are the ones that will have significant intrapelvic bleeding. The Glasgow Coma Scale in those patients is 10. In lateral compression injuries, the blood requirement is much less. So these patients aren't typically acutely bleeding from their pelvic ring injuries. However, notice that the Glasgow Coma Scale in the patients that Burgess reported was very low. And these are the patients that have significant incidence of concomitant closed head injury. So it's a lot of fun, actually, to be able to be in the trauma bay and look at the AP pelvis injury and, you know, diagnose what type of pelvic ring injury the patient has and be able to predict what other organ system injuries the patient has. So with anterior-posterior compression injuries, retroperitoneal hemorrhage occurs. With lateral compression injuries, you can have closed head injuries and intra-abdominal trauma as well. With vertical shear injuries, you also need to suspect intrapelvic bleeding. The acute management issues, you need to manage and control the retroperitoneal hematoma. You treat the open fractures as we described, and also enlist your colleagues, your urologic and general trauma colleagues to manage the urogenital injuries and the rectal injuries. The acute management goals are to limit the blood loss, minimize the sequelae of late sepsis, and stabilize the pelvis for early mobilization. Remember that if mortality is associated with hemodynamic instability, if you have a hemodynamically stable patient with a significant pelvic ring injury, the mortality is very low. On the other hand, if the patient is persistently hypotensive, the mortality goes up dramatically. The sources of blood loss can include intra-abdominal bleeding or intrathoracic bleeding, and those need to be ruled out. The patients need to have either a fast examination ultrasound study of their abdomen or a peritoneal lavage. They need to have a chest x-ray to rule out intrathoracic or intra-abdominal source of bleeding. If those sources are ruled out, then you really need to look at the pelvis as the source of ongoing blood loss. And remember that the pelvis is a tremendous potential space in which bleeding can occur. You have multiple, exposed cancer cellulose fracture surfaces that can bleed, as well as significant disruption to the posterior venous plexuses. If you have a high pressure type situation where you have dramatic hemodynamic instability, then you can suspect significant arterial injury. Arterial bleeding can occur, and this is in the order of frequency, most commonly from the superior gluteal artery, also occasionally from the internal pudendal, the obturator, or the lateral sacral. And this is what's seen on an angiogram here. Control of the retroperitoneal bleeding, the sort of tried and true mechanism for doing that in the literature is to external fixation of the pelvis. And basically what you do is to apply some pins in the anterior pelvic ring, reduce the pelvic volume, and thereby that will lead to tamponade of the vessels. And that works very well for patients in which the blood loss is from the posterior venous plexus. And again, that represents about 80% of the patients with significant bleeding from pelvic fractures. If the patient has ongoing hemodynamic instability after an external fixator has been placed on the pelvis or after some external technique has been used to reduce an open book pelvic fracture, those are the patients in which you need to consider arterial bleeding, and those patients need to go angiography with diagnostic and therapeutic intervention to control the arterial bleeding. This is a useful flow diagram. I'm not going to go through it in the risk of time here, but you can refer back to that and basically just list, you know, how you assess the patient, emphasizing the importance of ruling out intrathoracic and intra-abdominal bleeding, and then addressing the stabilization protocol for the pelvis. Now, what about the definitive stabilization of pelvic ring injuries? You can use an anterior external fixator. Certainly, that's a good resuscitative measure with 2 to 3 5-millimeter half pins in the anterior aspect of the pelvic ring. You can also consider placing a pin more anteriorly in the region of the anterior inferior iliac spine, which allows you to have a more lower profile external fixation construct. But I think most trauma surgeons do prefer plate fixation as definitive fixation for anterior pelvic ring injuries. You do not need to do an ORF lateral to the pubic tubercle if the posterior pelvic ring is stable. Posterior stabilization of pelvic ring injuries, anterior SI plating can be performed, or posterior tension band type plating. That has been shown to be associated with significant soft tissue complications and prominent hardware. Really, the use of iliosacral screws in the last 5 to 10 years has revolutionized our treatment of posterior pelvic ring injuries, because it can be inserted through a minimally invasive percutaneous technique. It's good for both sacral fractures and SI joint dislocations. The one caveat to that is you really need to be aware of potential iatrogenic injury to the L5 nerve root because of its location just anterior to the sacral ala. So that's shown here diagrammatically. This is the safe zone for placement of a iliosacral screw into the S1 vertebral body. You want to visualize that on your lateral fluoroscopic image of the sacrum, and then this is the correct orientation. And then I think this slide shows the inappropriate placement of a screw which penetrates through the anterior aspect of the sacral ala and could potentially damage the L5 nerve root. Pelvic ring injuries, outcomes, pain is the most common reason for a poor outcome, and poor outcomes have been associated with most commonly with incongruity of the sacroiliac joint. That's one take-home point to definitely remember. The sacroiliac joint must be anatomically reduced in patients with posterior pelvic ring injuries. If not, that is going to predictably lead to a poor outcome. If you have a high degree of initial displacement, malunions greater than 1 centimeter, leg length discrepancies greater than 2 centimeters, nonunions, or concomitant neurologic or urogenital injuries, those are also associated with poor prognosis. Deep venous thrombosis always needs to be considered in patients with pelvic ring trauma. It occurs in up to 60% of patients. It can manifest as either deep venous thrombosis or occasionally fatal PE. Prophylaxis is essentially important in these patients, either with mechanical compression and low molecular weight heparin. So you want to use actually mechanical and pharmacologic DV prophylaxis in these patients. Certain patients in which, for example, low molecular weight heparin may be contraindicated, such as a patient with a severe closed head injury, then that might be a patient that you would consider doing a vena cava filter. Sacral fractures, last thing to talk about, reported in up to 17 to 85% of pelvic ring injuries. They can be missed in 50% of patients that present with neurologic injury and in up to 75% of patients that present with neurologically intact. Lower sacral root function is responsible for anal sphincter tone, voluntary contracture, the bulbocavernosus reflex, and perianal sensation. If these lower sacral roots are disrupted, these are the types of long-term deficits you can expect. Imaging of the sacrum, an AP view in the 45-degree plane is helpful, as well as inlet and outlet views, as we mentioned, and then CT scan is really the study of choice. The knee classification scheme for sacrosacral fractures divides them into zones. Zone 1 are essentially your alar fractures that's lateral to the neural foramina. These typically are minimally displaced in APC and lateral compression injuries. In vertical shear fractures, however, these can be significantly displaced and will require treatment. Neurologic injury is relatively rare in these fractures and occurs in about 6%. And when it occurs, it is at the L5 nerve root. The zone 2 fractures are the transforaminal sacral fractures. And those are significant in that they have a significantly higher incidence of neurologic deficit either to the L5 or the first two sacral nerve roots. 97% of those can be undiagnosed in zones 1 or 2. Then the zone 3 injuries are essentially injuries that are basically spinal canal problems. They're medial to the neural foramina. The majority of those will have neurologic deficit, and they can cause caudal injury with bowel, bladder, and sexual dysfunction. Transverse fractures of the sacrum occur in the upper sacral segments or in the lower sacral segments. If they're in the upper portion of the sacrum, again, you have a higher incidence of bladder dysfunction. And the H fractures are particularly unstable and require surgical stabilization, typically stabilizing the sacrum to the lower lumbar spine. Neurologic injury in sacral fractures has the outcome has been shown to be improved with decompression. You can do it indirectly through reduction and stabilization of the sacral fracture, or you can do it on direct visualization through laminotomy and ventral foraminotomy. Postmortem studies have shown a high incidence of root avulsion with transforaminal vertical shear and transverse type fracture patterns of the sacrum. The treatment of zone 1 injuries, if it's stable and non-displaced, you treat them non-operatively with protected weight bearing. If it's minimally displaced, you can consider stabilization of the anterior ring if the symphysis is disrupted or you have a significant ramus fracture. The vertically unstable fracture should be treated with both anterior and posterior stabilization of the pelvic ring. Zone 2 treatment, where the foramina are patent, you can treat those non-operatively with protected weight bearing and frequent follow-up films, and you can expect some neurologic recovery in those patients. Again, that's where the foramina are patent and you don't suspect that there's compression of the nerve roots. If the fractures are unstable or you have foraminal compromise, those patients need direct or indirect decompression with anterior and posterior stabilization. Finally, zone 3 fractures that are stable and neurologically intact, non-operative treatment can be dictated by the associated fracture of the anterior pelvic ring. If they have neurologic deficit, they need decompression, anterior and posterior stabilization. Unilateral sacral nerve root preservation can be adequate for bowel and bladder control, so you at least want to have one of the nerve roots intact. Transverse fractures that are displaced need to be treated with lateral mass plates, again, commonly with fixation into the lower lumbar spine. So sacral fractures, anterior injuries can be managed with an anterior external fixer, an ORF. Then the posterior injuries can be treated with iliosacral screws. Again, beware the L5 nerve root. You can also use sacral bars or tension band plating. The problem with both of these techniques is that they do have significant potential for soft tissue compromise, and you can get overcompression, particularly of the lumbosacral nerve roots. Now, finish up with the top 10 facts for pelvic trauma, and sorry I'm running about 5 minutes behind, but remember that the posterior ligament structures are the strongest structures, they're the strongest structures in the body, and are responsible for the posterior stability of the pelvic ring. Urogenital injuries, when you have a severely displaced anterior ring fracture, wide open pubic symphysis diastasis, a high riding prostatic clinical exam, blood at the urethral meatus, those patients need to have a retrograde urethrogram. If they have persistent hematuria and the RUG is negative, then they need to have a cystogram to rule out a bladder rupture. External fixation, now this is, Dick mentioned this, but this is a little bit controversial. He says that external fixation should precede arteriogram in the hemodynamically unstable patient with an unstable pelvic fracture. I would modify that a little bit and to say that some sort of external immobilization of the pelvic ring. And I think most commonly what is done now, and I think what is probably appearing on standardized tests, is that you need to, if the patient is unstable, you've done adequate fluid resuscitation of the patient has a pelvic ring injury, they're unstable, they're hemodynamically unstable, the next treatment of choice would be due to some external immobilization of the pelvic ring. You can tie a sheet around the pelvis. You can place a beanbag, you know, something. And if that technique does not result in hemodynamic stability, then the patient should go to arteriogram before undergoing external fixation of the pelvic ring. Again, because we're now understanding that more instability is caused than we previously recognized by acute arterial bleeding, and performing an arterial embolization can be a life-saving procedure. So I would recommend that you kind of disregard this fact that he's mentioned, and really I do not think that in most cases external fixation should be performed before arteriography. And I can tell you for sure that's the way that the American College of Surgeons is training trauma surgeons today. The sources of arterial bleeding in descending order of frequency in the pelvic ring trauma: the superior gluteal artery is most common, followed by the internal pudendal, the obturator, and the lateral sacral. Diagnostic peritoneal lavage or fast ultrasound examination should be performed to rule out intra-abdominal source of bleeding. If you're going to do a DPL, encourage your trauma surgeons to do it through a supra-umbilical incision to avoid compromising your approaches for treatment of the pelvic ring. Open injuries into the rectum and perineum do require diverting colostomy. That's an important point to remember. And poor outcome in pelvic ring injuries is related most commonly to incongruity of the sacroiliac joint. So it's very important to obtain an anatomical reduction of the SI joint. Also, severe initial displacement, residual displacement less than 1 centimeter, and the other criteria that are mentioned there. Zone 3 sacral fractures are basically spinal canal disruptions, have the highest incidence of neurologic injury. They can have a caudal neurologic dysfunction with bowel, bladder, and sexual injuries, sexual dysfunction. And you see that as you go from a zone 1 to a zone 3 injury, there's a dramatically increased risk of neurologic dysfunction. Zone 1 injuries are the most common location of sacral fractures, up to 50%. Zone 2s and 3s are less frequent. The L5 nerve root is the structure most at risk with placement of an iliosacral screw. And again, that's the anterior location of the L5 nerve root, just anterior to the sacral ala. SI joint dislocations, again, require anatomical reduction and stabilization. And pubic rami fractures lateral to the pubic tubercle do not require fixation if the posterior pelvic ring is stable or if some stabilization is performed of it. So you don't really worry about these more lateral rami fractures. That's it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your attention.